Welcome, everybody. Looks like we do have a quorum. This is the first meeting of the Subcommittee on Insurance Reform on February 25th. Okay. This subcommittee was put together through the work of the working group, the Insurance Fraud Working Group, where a number of stakeholders came together, and we did some work for the last 2 years on insurance fraud. And this committee is now insurance reform. So welcome, everyone, the new senators that are participating in this process. Welcome to the committee. Glad to have you here. So the first bill that we're going to take up is Senate File 782, which is my bill. So
you want to do it for
Roger, can you just start us out here? Paul's coming to do this. But.
Sure.
Senator Jensen, welcome. If you want to start us off with walking us through Senate File 782, and then members, we do have a number of testifiers listed on your agenda, and then of course we'll open it up to anyone who may want to comment who's not listed on the agenda. And members, as well as the public, as I know you're well aware, this session we're under pretty tight timelines in terms of use of the room, so we'll try and hear everyone, but also keep the process moving forward. So, Senator Jensen, welcome to your own committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Before I get into the specifics of Senate File 782, I do have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment, that I'd like to put on the bill to get it in the shape that I would like.
Right. Members, does everyone have the A2 amendment? Seeing nods, all right. Senator Jensen, do you want to just talk about the A2 amendment briefly?
The A2 amendment removes sections 2 and 3 and replaces it with new language.
Right. Members, this is an author's amendment. So Senator Jensen moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Senator Jensen, please.
Now, at this point, I would like to make an oral amendment, too.
All right, to 782 as amended, oral
to
amendment.
The A2 amendment.
That's correct.
Yeah, we can amend it.
Section 3, subdivision 2A, I want to replace healthcare provider with the word person.
Council, do you have any comment on
no,
that?
No, that's good. Got it.
Members, again, that would be if you're using the A2 as a reference, we put the A2 on, but if you're using the A2 as a reference, that would be line 1.19, subdivision 2A, striking healthcare provider and inserting person. Senator Jensen moves that amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. And that oral amendment is adopted. So, Senator Jensen, 782 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Insurance fraud has probably existed since the first insurance policy was written, but today there's greater attention than ever before that's been given to this serious problem that affects us all. The Senate Commerce Committee has focused on this issue, like I spoke about earlier, with several people devoting time and effort to do several things: to reduce the opportunity to commit insurance fraud, to improve insurance fraud detection capabilities, to further efforts of investigating insurance fraud, and to promote rigorous prosecution of people who commit insurance fraud. The work of the fraud working group sent a message that there are steps that we can take legislatively that can also send the message that we will not tolerate insurance fraud. Cases of suspected fraud will be investigated, and anyone who is considering committing fraud should think twice before doing it. Insurance is affected by fraud claims in much the same way as other businesses that are targeted by criminals. So as an example, when shoplifters steal from stores, they're forced to hire detectives or install expensive video equipment to help them identify and catch those shoplifters. It works the same way for insurance theft. The property and casualty insurance companies alone are spending up to $200 million every year to fight insurance fraud, and those expenses get passed on to the consumer. We all pay the cost of insurance fraud, not only in higher premium costs for our own insurance, but the rising cost of commercial insurance that gets passed on in higher prices for the goods and services that we buy. Law enforcement agencies have found it necessary to use the majority of their time catching what we consider more dangerous criminals. Prosecutor officers and the courts have always been understaffed and have overloaded with cases, so fraud perpetrators have felt fairly safe from prosecution. Even today, those who commit fraud believe the worst that can happen to them is simply they just won't get paid by the insurance company. Typically, insurance fraud occurs when someone tries to profit from an insurance transaction through lies or misrepresentations. Most professionals are honest and trustworthy. Some, however, have falsified records, assisted people in fabricating injuries to collect large bodily injury settlements or awards in lawsuits based on fraudulent claims. This also includes insurance providers who also violate insurance laws, for example, by misrepresenting during an insurance sale or inappropriately canceling policies or denying coverages. What we're trying to do here is balance with legislation to protect all of the good, honest, hardworking professionals, yet deters and penalizes those that choose to steal. And that's no matter what occupation or profession that they're in. I went out to the Minnesota Department of Commerce Fraud Bureau website, and if you go out there, they have an annual report that's listed out there. I was only able to find 2008 to 2012 data. I'm not exactly sure where to find the rest, but within those reports, in 2008, there were 924 fraud referrals to the Fraud Bureau. In 2012, it was 1,424. That's an increase of about 65%. National statistics show that states with strong anti-fraud programs have lower insurance rates, and insurance fraud cases are easier to prosecute. These anti-fraud measures work. So Senate File 782 addresses three areas: accident data privacy, civil penalties, and the prevention of payment to those that have been convicted of fraud. So if you look at the bill, Section 1 involves accident data. Minnesota statute currently allows the immediate release of accident report information to third parties. That information is sold to providers who can use it to contact accident victims. This bill would add a 30-day cooling-off period before that information can be made available. And I want to talk a little bit and jump to Section 4. That involves some exemptions that we've made to that. And that would include the accident insurance company, the insurance agent, the victim services programs that are available, radio and television stations, newspapers, and the Commissioner of Commerce. Section 2 allows the Commissioner, upon recommendation by the Fraud Bureau, to impose administrative penalties up to $25,000 for each act of insurance fraud committed by that person. They can also order restitution suffering loss if the penalty has not been paid after all rights of appeal have been waived or exhausted. The commissioner may bring a civil action to collect the penalty, including expenses and litigation costs and reasonable attorney fees along with interest. Section 3, if you are convicted of insurance fraud, you may not enforce a contract for payment from the insured or what is called the reparation obligor, which means an insurer, self-insurer, or an obligated government providing basic or added reparation benefits. With that, I've brought some people along with me to talk about this more, and I think we'll begin, if that's okay, with yes. Howard Goldblatt. He's the executive director of the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud.
Good afternoon. Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Howard Goldblatt, and I am not the executive director. I'm only the director of government affairs of the coalition.
Sorry about that.
You gave me a promotion. I'm not going to read my testimony, but just will summarize some of the points which would buttress what Senator Jensen has stated. The coalition is a broad-based alliance of consumer groups, insurance companies, and government organizations dedicated to combating all forms of insurance fraud through public education, advocacy, and research. We're recognized as one of the leading anti-fraud organizations in the nation. We've worked with legislators and regulators around the nation to strengthen insurance fraud laws and regulations. The issue here in Minnesota, and we see it elsewhere as well, where organized rings see the road of least resistance, and they've recognized that Minnesota is ripe for their type of fraud, which is medical mills, staged crash rings, etc. And so they have come here. We have seen an uptick of what we would call organized fraud rings using Minnesota fraud laws for their own purposes. We refer to the increased cost that fraud gives as a fraud tax, that consumers end up paying more for goods and services, more for insurance, because of the amount of fraud that's being committed. All costs gets borne by the consumer. Insurance companies do not eat up their expenses that they have to pay out in fraudulent activity. And the fraud referrals that Senator Jensen referred to increasing over the last few years, that's really the tip of the iceberg. Because what we've recognized over the years is that the amount of referrals that are sent to a state insurance fraud bureau, regardless of what state we're talking about, is really a percentage of the real amount of fraud being committed. Because what those referrals are those identified by insurance companies who then refer to the fraud bureau. Because there are plenty of frauds being committed on a daily basis in Minnesota and elsewhere that are not being captured, identified by insurance fraud investigators. Now, as to the provisions, restricting access, what I call to crash reports, it is not new. It is not unique. None of these provisions are unique to Minnesota. They are all in law somewhere else in the nation. I see the crash reports as a privacy issue, as much as an anti-fraud issue. If I'm a party to an automobile crash, I understand that I have access to it, that my insurer, any provider, any attorney I have will have access to it, as well as any person involved in the crash. What I don't understand, and I don't realize why, would a third party, not party to the crash, have access? Why should a third party, not party to the crash, find my personal identifying information that tells them who I am, where I live, and how to contact me? Why should I be contacted by a third party that I may not want to be contacted by? So what this bill does, it helps protect consumers from being solicited by non-parties to the crash. It doesn't stop anyone who's a party to the crash from getting that information. As for the civil fines, I worked with the Maryland Insurance Administration on legislation that they enacted a couple of years ago, which gives that department authority to go after people who commit insurance fraud civilly. This is to target the fraud rings who they may or may not be able to go through criminal charges, but they go after the profit motive of the fraud. It gets into the wallets of the fraudsters. And that's the key element that we see from that provision. As for the third provision, what I use the term deauthorizing because I picked that up from the state of New York. They enacted this provision several years ago that basically, like Minnesota, they have a no-fault insurance system, and under their provision under their enforcement, they are able now to target providers who use the auto insurance system to commit fraud, and they can deauthorize, to use the New York language, from a provider from gaining access to any payment from the system. It is not a license revocation. Anyone who is licensed retains their license. They just do not have access to getting paid from the insurance system that they've defrauded. The coalition has a long-standing belief that people who are licensed by the state should not use that license to commit fraud. A license is a privilege and not a right. If people use their license to commit fraud, to commit a crime, the state needs to have additional penalties like this provision to penalize those providers who are violating their privilege that the state has bestowed upon them. We strongly support this bill. We made these recommendations to the initial task force, and we hope you will move this bill forward. Thank you.
Members, any questions for Mr. Goldblatt? Members, in your packet, I don't think it was mentioned, but Mr. Goldblatt's letter, the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud, it shows all the different groups that are supporting this. It's really a very, very diverse group, so you should take a look at that. And Senator Jensen, before we go to the next testifiers, do you want to address at all the work that was done the last couple of years, and that this was really part of a different bill? And so, because we tried to work with a number of groups to bring this together, and this by itself may be perceived as lopsided, but if you look at the whole thing that we were trying to do, I think it takes on a different light. So if you would address that, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I said earlier, there was a working group that was put together, and we spent the interim, several meetings, lots of stakeholders, providing input into what could we do when it came to insurance fraud, what could we do legislatively. And so we put together recommendations from that task, from that working group, and one of the recommendations was to create this subcommittee, which I believe we are the only one in the nation that has a group specifically looking at insurance reform. And we also put together legislation that we carried last year. And parts of the bill didn't proceed through that process, but they still, we made some changes and did some work on it. So the provisions that you see in this particular bill have changes made to it from the input that we received through the next interim and working with the stakeholders where their concerns were in regards to the three provisions that you see in this bill now. For instance, I can give you a good example. We tried the accident solicitation at 90 days, and we didn't provide any exceptions for that rule. And we learned that that was not probably the best way to go. So now we changed it to 30 days, and we've provided access by the people that actually need to have the access that are access to that information because they're involved with the crash.
Thank you. That was good. Mr. Franzen, do you want to speak next? You're on the list.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention, too, that Ramsey County Attorney John Choi was meaning to come today. He was not able to come, but I want you to know that he supports the bill and was going to be here in support of what we're doing here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I am appearing on behalf of the National Insurance Crime Bureau, a national organization composed essentially of ex-law enforcement and ex-FBI agents, and our job is to identify, track, and ferret out fraud in cooperation with law enforcement. We have two agents in Minnesota. Now, I would like to answer a couple questions that legislators seem to ask about this bill and more about fraud in general. But before that, I would say in one respect, this is a very lopsided bill. There is a strong bias against that group of people, which Anoka County Attorney John Palumbo describes as bad people doing bad things to good people. In other words, it's lopsided. Crooks will not like this bill. So it's not totally a compromise. The questions I'd like to address is first, is there increased insurance fraud in Minnesota? We've had this. Senator Jensen gave you statistics about the dramatic uptick in the Fraud Bureau investigations. You have seen the Commerce Committee has had a presentation by the Fraud Bureau talking about their work, and both of which lead me to say, yes, there is an uptick. Our data shows the same thing, and prosecutors tell us the same thing. Insurance fraud is on the rise in Minnesota. The natural question is why? Well, the top five states for insurance fraud in the country by our statistics are New York, Texas, Maryland, California, and Florida. And Mr. Goldblatt said these are the very states that are putting in tough bills that we are modeling this legislation after. Well, these are organized criminals, and they're migrating. They may be bad people, but they're not dumb people. No Fault is a great system. It's consumer-friendly. It is slightly more susceptible to fraud than the tort system, and the bad guys know that. There is a migration here. Our data supports it. Law enforcement people tell us the same thing, and I think that's why it's incumbent on the legislature to do something about it and slam the door on the fraudsters. I'd like to give you an example of a couple of the schemes that go on. The first one, in some Minnesota, some not. But these are the types of schemes fraudsters engage in. Now, the first is I was on the FBI website. There was a press release from 2013 where a New York attorney had just pled guilty to being part of a fraud ring, which by FBI estimate had cheated consumers out of $279 million. It was a conspiracy between clinics, businessmen, false corporations, and for treatment, false lawsuits, et cetera. There are at least 10 people in jail today as a result of that joint FBI-New York investigation. That's basically in the medical area, and we may hear from lawyers and medical providers, but they're not the only group that, you know, fraud. There are a lot of different frauds. And, Mr. Chair, I know you're an agent, so I'll give you an agent fraud case. It was one I was involved with. Working with the Commerce Department, in which a person had insurance bound, had a claim, and the company I represented refused to pay on the basis we had never heard of this person. Well, through the course of the investigation, it became apparent to someone, and this is in Duluth, someone had gotten a hold of a company logo, I don't know if it's off the internet, used a computer, and dummied up letterhead. And phonied up some binders having nothing to do with any insurance company and went peddling these binders, getting money from people, and then disappearing. That was not the insurance company that was hurt. It was the injured victim that was the victim of that particular fraud, and that's unfair. This bill will address that. One of the most tragic frauds we see, and, you know, thank God we have not seen this in Minnesota yet, is what you call the counterfeit airbags, where you may have a car repaired and you get defective second-rate airbags put in. And the only time this fraud is detected is when an airbag deploys unsuccessfully or unexpectedly. Again, people, that's an evil conspiracy. That's just flat-out evil. And those things do go on. And finally, the latest I heard about is some guy goes in a parking lot, sees a piece of broken glass, says, I'll repair your windshield for free. Just give me your insurance company's name and your policy number. People do that, and what they get is a low-quality, cheap windshield put on, improperly installed, again, a major safety hazard, and the person runs. If anyone in a parking lot at the Mall of America comes to you and offers to replace your windshield, do not take them up on the offer. There are plenty of tremendous glass vendors here. Those are the types of schemes that go around, and they're limited only by the creativity of the schemers. The bill does three things. All have been proven to work. The accident report restriction. It's very clear. These batches of accident reports that by and large brokers get and sell sell to people, is the mother's milk of fraud. That's where you get unnecessary over-treatment, unnecessary and sometimes dangerous treatment on people. It's clear when Texas put a restriction on accident reports, the fraudsters moved to Arkansas. They do migrate. So then Arkansas put this on. In both cases, fraud's down. The second piece is very easy. It gives the Commissioner of Commerce authority to impose up to $25,000 fine based on the recommendation of the Fraud Bureau, and that's a civil fine. This is not criminal, against fraudsters. And that is mitigated. Current statute, 14.045, I believe, talks about all the factors the commissioner and any commissioner must weigh when they impose the fines. And the fine has to be commensurate with the offense, or else the fine is arbitrary and capricious and no good. It will not stand. $25,000 has been modeled from other states. And also, if you look at the amount of medical benefits, it's $20,000 as a mandatory minimum. Simply, this makes it more expensive to get caught committing fraud than the money you can make by successfully perpetrating a fraud. It's a deterrent as well. And our information is states, I believe it's Maryland, they are using this, and they're catching people, and they move forward. Again, a civil remedy beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal prosecution is extraordinarily difficult to achieve. We've been told that we know to a 98% or 99% certainty this person is guilty. That may not be enough for a prosecutor. You need beyond any reasonable doubt. So a civil penalty is necessary, it's important, and most of all, it works. The final piece is what Mr. Goldblatt has referred to as deauthorization. It initially was patterned after the New York law, which has been very successful, but we've put our Minnesota twist to it. Mr. Chairman, in Minnesota, we like to make things a little better, and particularly in the interest of efficient government. We took out a lot of the administrative steps at all and said something very simple. If you are convicted criminally of fraud, insurance fraud, your contract with the no-fault victim and the insurance company is void. Simply, you can't get paid for it. I, as a no-fault victim, can go to someone convicted of fraud and they can treat me if they want, but I don't have to pay them. We think that's a tremendous disincentive for convicted fraudsters. And the question is, do you want the people who have these criminal convictions to be treating our accident victims? With all due respect, I would say no. That's fairly clear. And I would sum up, Mr. Chair, it's a simple bill. We've been working with folks to try to make it more efficient. There are some people who do have concerns. I think they're ill-founded, but we'll talk about that more. But at the end of the day, this works, and it will reduce insurance fraud in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Members, any questions? Thank you, Mr. Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next on the list, we have Bob Johnson, President of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Where's our page? Double duty today. Good afternoon, Mr. Johnson. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And I have about 3 points I want to make, Mr. Chairman. I won't be repetitive for Mr. Goldblatt or Mr. Franzen, but and before those points, just first a thank you to you, Senator Jensen, to you, Chairman Metzen, and to the members of the subcommittee and the members that committed to the Insurance Fraud Working Group and took the time and frankly put the fight against insurance fraud in Minnesota on the national map. I think you're hearing that today from organizations like Mr. Goldblatt's and the National Insurance Crime Bureau, and we need to be on the map fighting this. So just a thank you to all the committee members and this ongoing commitment and fight, and as Senator Jensen mentioned, the fact that individuals like Ramsey County Attorney John Choi and the Anoka County Attorney Tony Palumbo and others are coming to press conferences and wanting to stand together with the legislators on a bipartisan basis is encouraging, and we need to do more. So the bill before you, Senate File 782, is an important follow-up to address, recognize gaps, holes, problems, whatever you want to call them, in the Minnesota no-fault system. Mr. Chairman, if the committee members will just pick up, and I'll just highlight a couple of key points, if I can, to supplement what you've heard so far. The first that you have in front of you, it's just recently released research from the Insurance Research Council. So this is a national statistical. This is not a lobbying organization. They put out comprehensive studies and data, and this is the results of a 35,000-plus closed claim study from auto insurers that represent over half of the market countrywide. And just to show you, on a current basis, from the statistics and the data and the claims being paid, the magnitude of fraud, and particularly in auto insurance claims, and the Senate File 782 focuses on auto insurance, just so you can see the numbers and see the Minnesota ranking. Unfortunately, we have a high ranking, which is not good, but the high ranking in terms of the amount of fraud and fraud buildup. So you see that $7.7 billion being paid out in money that I believe everybody in the room, if it's fraud, would agree should not be paid out. These are dollars that should not. This isn't an issue for the nation's auto insurers. This is an issue for the nation's consumers. They are paying for this. So to show you the just the magnitude of it, show you that Minnesota is a top state for the percentage identified of fraud and fraud buildup. And if you flip to the back, Mr. Chairman, you'll see that the trend is going in the wrong way. In other words, it's increasing in terms of the money that's being paid out for fraud. So just that, so that you all see on a current basis with factual documentation from claims paid what's happening around the country. The second thing, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a hand up, but I do want to read for the subcommittee members a paragraph out of a letter, and it's in a public record of a recent agency rulemaking proceeding regarding another issue, but it deals with fraud, and it deals with Minnesota fraud, and it deals with fraud in our Minnesota no-fault system. So Mr. Franzen described some of the types of fraud, but I'd like to give the subcommittee members, here's Minnesota. So the lawyer actually is the gentleman, Rick Stemple. And again, it's a public letter, so I'm reading out of it, and you could access it in the record. I'll just read part of it. At the present time, I'm representing multiple no-fault insurers with respect to a staged auto accident ring which has operated in the Twin Cities since at least 2011. We have obtained multiple confessions from participants who have testified that the ring has staged a minimum of 300 to 500 motor vehicle accidents with approximately 4,000 no-fault claims filed in connection with the ring. These damages caused by the ring activity is in excess of $50 million of no-fault benefits paid out in false claims in Minnesota since 2011. He couldn't supply the sworn statement confessions because it's part of an ongoing criminal investigation. But the point is that I just want the committee members to know this isn't New York and Florida, and you'll see no-fault states, unfortunately, on the short list of where the abuse and the fraud is significant. But that's just current real evidence and just information for the subcommittee that this is a Minnesota problem. It's happening in the Minnesota no-fault system. It's real. It's right here. It's real dollars that consumers are paying for that I think we would all agree that they shouldn't be paying for. The last document I'll just reference, and I haven't handed this out, but I think some of you have seen it. But I think it's fair to ask the question, if we pass these laws, does this make any difference for consumers? That's a fair question, and we have to be able to address that as an industry. And we can look to the state of Florida. So Florida is also on the short list of significant no-fault fraud because they have a PIP, personal injury protection, first-party benefit. That is where fraud is often focused. Now, the Florida passed significant anti-fraud reforms to their no-fault system in 2012. And frankly, some of those, there's a lot of pieces, I'm not saying they're comparable, some of the pieces in that bill are, in fact, some of the items that you see in Senator Jensen's bill, Senate File 782. And Florida had a significant fraud tax on consumers. So the point is this. Here's the answer to the question, does it make any difference? Now, what I'm going to quote for you is quotes that come out of the Florida Commerce Department, looked at to quantify the effects. Since the law went into effect in January 2013, the Florida Department of Financial Services reports a substantial decline in PIP fraud with a projected 16% decrease during fiscal year 2013-14 compared to fiscal year 2011-12. PIP rates, personal injury protection rates in Florida, in the 2 years before they passed their law had increased 43%. After passage of the law and the period that they could measure, they decreased 13.6%. So I just state that, Mr. Chairman, and I am not stating that, and I know Senator Jensen's not there. I'm not talking about comparable numbers because the reforms aren't the same. What I'm stating and testifying, as the previous witnesses did, these reforms can make a difference in what it's costing consumers for auto insurance. And I do believe genuinely that everybody in this room, and I've been part of a number of meetings and reaching out with the various interest groups, nobody defends fraud. I know that, and I'm pleased with that, and I would expect that. But we have to dial in the reforms. We've got to get at the practices that are causing us to have, unfortunately, kind of a bright neon sign at our borders that invites people to come here, and they are coming here. You've heard the testimony and the documentation of this reverse migration of criminal activity from the East Coast to Minnesota. That was a study that was presented last year by Mr. Lynch from the NICB to this committee of the data that the auto insurers are reporting. So I think the case, Mr. Chairman, subcommittee members, is clear. We need to do this. I commend Senator Jensen and Senator Metz and all of you and on both sides of the House and the Senate for the process, what we're about. Let's keep at it. Let's help Minnesota consumers. Let's take the costs out of the system. There's enough costs that we'll have other studies and processes that we're looking at that we need to look at. Let's do more to diminish what this is doing to negatively affect consumers in Minnesota and this state in terms of the cost of auto insurance. So I'll stop at that, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Johnson, if there's a way that we can get a copy of that Florida Commerce Department results, I think really critical because it's hopefully mostly nonpartisan. You know, they're really trying to protect the consumer, and I think that'd be good for us all to see that. Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I see we have a couple of chiropractor lobbyists on the list. Do you want Senator Jensen, you want to take them one at a time or both together? It's up to you.
They can come up as long as there's room.
Okay, sounds good. Two former representatives, I might add. So. Mr. Goodnow, state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I hope you don't hold that against us.
Well,
just a little bit.
The future has
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Goodnow. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractors Association, representing over 700 chiropractors in the state of Minnesota. And I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate File 782, and in particular Sections 2 and 3. And I want to focus on those sections because they're additional powers that have been pushed forward to really deal with purportedly the fraud that people see or are claiming are in the no-fault auto insurance industry. But I think we need to back up a little bit and reflect a little bit on the testimony that's been provided so far. We've heard, and it seems to me that the studies that have been provided, the analysis that have been done, and the spokespeople we've heard from are either partially or fully funded by the insurance industry. So there's clearly, even though there's a claim of no bias there, there has to be a bias. And so let's take it in perspective and think about it from that perspective. One person who testified said that each one of these individual sections has solved the problem of fraud in the state that it was applied in. And yet in Minnesota, we want to apply all three of them without understanding how within the context of the Minnesota system. So maybe the best thing isn't to throw all three of them at the wall at the same time, but maybe to try to look at one thing at a time incrementally, because based on the testimony, they said that by just passing one of these, it solves the problem and has had very effective results in the states that it's been applied to. So maybe rather than doing three, we should look at one. But really, I want to thank, first of all, Senator Jensen and other folks for actually visiting with us and working with us to try to refine the language that's in sections 2 and 3. I still have some concerns, and we've been working on that to try to figure out exactly what the implications of the changes are. On section 2 in particular, and I'll refer to the A2 amendment, it talks about the administrative penalty being able to be levied based on the recommendation of the Commerce Fraud Bureau, which actually is an arm of the Department of Commerce. So it's basically the commissioner can they impose the administrative penalty upon the recommendation of the commissioner. I mean, that's kind of the way the agencies work. And so it's really not a separate outside organization that's making this recommendation. And then it's saying that it's for penalties for if insurance fraud is committed. Now, in the way I view things, that if there's a commission of insurance fraud under 609.611, that would require a conviction of that. Because otherwise, no fraud is committed until it actually is there's a conviction that goes along with that. Based on the testimony I've heard from Mr. Franson, it was that this is not going to be requiring a conviction. And so I think there needs to be some clarity to the language here. If it is requiring a conviction, then committed should be convicted rather than committed. If not, then we have further problems with that because the evidentiary standards would vary. And, Mr. Chair, I see you're checking with counsel to see what that means. But the evidentiary standards for a criminal conviction is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is that 98%, that high percentage, because you're taking away some life and liberty issues from an individual. The fines related to a criminal conviction are far less and on a scalable basis than this $25,000 fine that can be done on a civil basis. So the concern is we have this, quote, fraud going on out there, and we can't convict them because we don't have beyond a reasonable doubt proof that these people are committing the fraud. So we want another standard in place, another ability to go in and penalize these people who we don't like what they're doing. So we want a preponderance of the evidence or a different standard. And since the civil penalty related to that or the financial penalty related to that is actually a higher penalty than what can be imposed under the criminal action. And so I have a problem with that disconnect. And I also, quite frankly, have a problem with giving that much authority to the Department of Commerce for going after bad actors. Because I think the one thing that I've heard is there's been a lot of use of the word fraud being thrown around. And I think the definition from the insurance company is it's actions we don't like or actions we think are wrong, but they actually aren't illegal, and it's just something that they don't like to deal with. For example, there was a big – and last year when we were doing these hearings, there was a much publicized case of civil action taken by an insurance company against 40-some chiropractors in the state of Minnesota. Allegations of fraud were being thrown out there by testifiers at that point. That case was dismissed. Unfortunately, in the process, a number of small chiropractors decided to settle the case with the insurer because they didn't want to incur the legal fees that would go along with defending their honor with regard to those claims. That's an abuse of power in my perspective. The big guys with the big money, big advertising budgets, the big resources to be able to do research going after the small guy, the person that you see on your street corners providing chiropractic services and other healthcare services throughout Minnesota. So just keep that in perspective. So when we are concerned about this type of additional authority, we have good reason to be concerned about it because we've seen some recent abuses by the insurance company, quite frankly, where they pursued that. On Section 3, we clearly do not have a concern about penalties being related to people being convicted of insurance fraud. The debarment or deauthorization mechanism that's done here is very similar to what's being done on Medicaid and Medicare. I believe on that OIG blacklist, there's a way that you can get off of it. And the only concern I would have here is that depending upon what the level of conviction is and what the breadth of the crime is, that there's no ability to get off of it. In addition to all these administrative penalties and the criminal actions, you still have the professional boards that can go after folks that feel are a threat to the public health and fraudulent to the public, and they can pull that license if need be. This is something separate from that, and this is dealing with the whole issue of additional civil penalties and taking away a payment source for services that are rightfully being provided. So with that, again, sounds that I'm really negative. I do appreciate the fact that we've moved in the right direction. I do have concerns about the tone of the testimony that preceded me and in supporting this bill, because I do think there's fraud out there and we want to address it, but I think we have to be careful about how that can impact the person out there who's acting legitimately and providing good service to the community. Thank you for your time.
Members, any questions? So you're going to continue to work with us to make it the best.
Mr. Chairman, I'm committed to working with you through this. And actually, these might be some good topics to be part of the discussion that would take place with that task force that you have listed as the next bill.
Thank you. Mr. Abler, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my first time at a witness table in this role, so it's nice that I can be in front of you. And thank you for the opportunity. My client is Summa MRI and Doctors Lodge. And parallel interest to Mr. Goodnow, a little different perspective perhaps, and I hadn't even read that committed thing until I heard him, so it's good to listen to lawyers talking about stuff. So just want to reiterate that we're all against fraud, and I find it, and being a chiropractor myself, I find it embarrassing to be with some people who find themselves the target of some of these operations, and I think you're aware it's a distinct minority, very small minority. They make the news, and we are in favor of every effort to make them behave, while the large majority of my colleagues help people get restored to their previous state and do really, really good work. And so I think you want to remember, as this goes forward, the goal of the no-fault law is to restore losses and restore people to their former state as well as they can be. I have some comments about the other task force thing, which in total will be my total comments. I won't repeat myself there, but just to say that you and I, Mr. Chair, were the leaders of the kind of the first successful group. We got a little small project out of a group, and the trick in this topic is to keep everybody at the table. And it becomes kind of a push-me-pull-you divorce court type operation if you're not careful. And so it's with those that background committed to proper care for people who are rightly injured, and strongly against all the discussion Mr. Franzen addressed and these rings and so on, which is not anything related to my client or Mr. Goodnow's client, that we're here talking about that. I urge the committee to be aware of unintended consequences. And so when you go after the rings and write laws that could get them, this committed word is important. There's some people who can be caught up in this that aren't even on the list by somebody who's a relative aggressive commissioner or somebody who just happens to fall prey. And I'm kind of sorry I took Section 2 out all the way. And the boards can be useful, a useful tool to help you in your fight against fraud and when it comes to the providers. There is no board who is serving the practitioners, medical, chiro, nurse, PT, and all that tolerates this sort of activity. And so losing your license is a big deal. And there are tools properly used that can be very effective in getting providers to behave better. I just have a couple of questions. Let me step back. Just the fraud issues are not limited to providers, however, Mr. Chair. There is fraud on the part of the insurance companies, where they wrongfully deny. There is fraud on the part of some attorneys. And so we'll have some discussions about that. But the providers have no standing to go back after them. They don't have the resources of a premium dollars to the person pays premiums, and then they use those premiums sometimes to go after the very client who was paying the money to say that they were not correct. There is an example of a pattern of abuse that I will bring to you that you want to be sure you address. And that's where an insurance company may have a claim transmitted to them, and they decide not to pay or deny, but they're going to investigate the claim. And they investigate it for a period of time. They may make a payment to an attorney, but they don't tell the provider anything about the status. Most attorneys are totally cool. In one case in particular, I'm not naming names or any companies, this individual signed checks that were made out joint to this, it was to the attorney on behalf of the client, the patient, and then to the provider. And this, with only one signature, this attorney cashed the checks. And because the insurance company was unwilling to discuss any details of the status of the claim with the provider has no recourse but to go after the attorney, who is dishonest and not returning phone calls and actually keeping the money. And that's something we could discuss, I think, in the work group. But this is an example. And so my question for you, Mr. Chair, that you can think about is on line 1.7 of the amendment, is the word person, is an insurance company a person? Is an attorney considered a person? That's just something you can ruminate on. If that's the case, it would give the commissioner the authority to go over and to deal with those matters as well if there's an infraction.
That's true.
It does. Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Yes, that is correct. Person includes, and maybe council wants to voice their opinion on that too, but it's
interesting.
Mr. Chairman, there's no more specific definition of purpose, or I'm sorry, person in Chapter 45, so you default to the general definition in Chapter 645, and person doesn't include corporations, partnerships, LLCs, all entities corporate and individual. So it would pick up those.
And Mr. Chair, that's why the oral amendment on my behalf.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And so I appreciate the fact that we're putting everybody on notice. It's time to behave. And remember, at the end of the day, help the client. Help the patient get better. Yeah. And I just have a few more thoughts. I want to caution the committee that on line 20, the word fraud under 6 and however they're committed or convicted of it, it may not even be related to no fault. It could be an application that they did on their own, and now they could be barred. And so just above all, do no harm and make sure that that people are going to have not an unintended consequence of this, just to caution you. And so they're curiously, it's a no-fault bill, but they're only barred from no-fault. So they've committed insurance fraud. Why aren't they barred from HMO payments? Why is there no mandated review by the board to look at their license? So I'm just offering you, and I have no problem with people who are dishonest losing their right to bill. And just another thought as this goes forward, is there a limit on time? We're a state that believes in remediation and people can be rehabilitated. So someone does this bad deed, is this a lifetime bar or is it a 5-year limit or is it a rebuttable presumption that they can't get it but they get it after some time they could appeal to the commissioner? Just a thought as it goes forward. But I also want to, and I generally support the work you're doing and my client is very comfortable with the content of the bill that, as with the exceptions being listed by Mr. Goodnow and just my caveats by me. But I want to remind you, Mr. Chair, that if this bill goes forward, the dance will continue. Mm-hmm. People who are intent on fraud are really smart. And a $25,000 fine is not a lot of money to those folks. They deal in the millions. You said $50 million. But $25,000, that's a pretty good little nick, and then I'm going to change my name of the company that I may be. I may hire a new graduate in whatever a profession may be. Then they can bill fraudulently. And now they've escaped your entire bar, and the dance will continue. And so which will dovetail with my comments coming up, the way to resolve all this is by a friendly dialogue with all the players as you're envisioning in the next bill. And, keep the bill. If I were in charge, and I'm clearly not in charge of anything anymore, Mr. Chair, I would hold this bill as part of a package you're going to assemble and then bring out a balanced package. And it's not my decision to make, but I really appreciate your kindness letting me testify, and it really is interesting being in this chair for this time. And, Madam Chair, I appreciate your kindness. And
Mr. Abler, it's kind of fun to see you on that side. And I do want the committee to know that former Representative Abler, it was either you contacted me or I contacted you. I'm not sure how it happened, or we bumped into each other, and we both acknowledged that, yes, there are some things that we should try to do, and it's harder than we all thought, and so that's why what Senator Jensen and Senator Metzen have been doing has been, and Senator Kent have all been, I think, making progress, so I certainly want to say that you have been part of the solution, not a part of the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with that, I see Mr. Carlson waiting in the wings to put his stamp of approval on this, I'm assuming. And Mr. Carlson, before you start, I figure if you were almost good with 90 days, 30 days must be perfect.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson, and I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And our members represent the consumers that are impacted by insurance and insurance decision. And that's our perspective on this. And, of course, we oppose fraud. We support tools to combat the crime, whether it's the largest fraud ever, like AIG and credit default swaps, or a staged car accident. Mm-hmm. We support efforts to give not only agencies but consumers the tools to combat that activity, and we think there are improvements that you can make. But our concern has always been and continues to be that we don't put the stigma of fraud on legitimate and legal conduct. And that is our concern about this, and we worry that you're not really always getting accurate information about the scope of the problem and the number of people that are involved. You know, I did read the Insurance Research Council report on fraud and buildup, and buildup is a new term now. That's when they have to re-side the fourth side of your house when all other three sides were damaged in the storm. That's buildup. We don't think that's fraud. And so I worry about these terms. You know, when you think about it, there were 1,700 in that report, 1,700 cases of suspected fraud in their closed files. These are cases that they didn't investigate, that they didn't put into arbitration, that they just paid, that they now come back and say there were 1,700 suspected cases of fraud or buildup. They don't tell us which is which. And to put that in perspective, according to the Department of Public Safety and Crash Facts, 180,000 Minnesotans were involved in automobile accidents last year. It involved 77,000 vehicles, and over 35,000 Minnesotans were injured. 17% is somewhere on the big number, or less than 1%, or of suspected fraud or buildup at best, maybe 5% of the total claims that they processed for all of those claims. So I want to keep in perspective the size of the problem as well. And it's all bad, and we don't support any of it. But we have enough trouble getting legitimate claims paid. When they're paying claims that they come back after the fact and say, we suspect this was wrong, it just defies logic to us. I'm going to comment on the amendment, Mr. Chairman, first, and then I want to go back to the change from 90 days down to 30. On the amendment, Mr. Chairman, I think it is Mr. Goodnow made some excellent points about whether or not this requires a conviction before the department commissioner could take action. I don't believe that's the case, and I think that should be clear. Simply a recommendation to the commissioner by the Fraud Bureau, who cannot make findings. When you look at Chapter 45 and what they can do, they can build up an investigation. They can submit a suspected fraud activity to a prosecutor. But that agency itself does not make findings. And so based on solely a recommendation of this group who cannot make findings, I think to allow the commissioner to go forward on that needs to be clarified at a minimum, because I don't think that that is a strong enough bar. The other thing that I would note on lines 1.19 on the amendment, I want to talk about this later when we talk about accident records. Insurance fraud is indeed codified in 609.611. But they didn't add 609.612, which is the crime for employing a runner, a capper, or a steerer. And it's always been this way, and it bothers me, because that's what they talk about is the problem with accident records, but yet we don't even include that as a prosecutable crime under this section. I'd also note, Mr. Chairman and members, that while we support the lines 1.13 and 1.14, that would allow the a consumer or an insurance company who's been wronged by insurance fraud to include their litigation expenses, costs, and reasonable attorney fees. We don't have that ability right now. Consumers don't have that ability to get made whole right now, whether it's a fraudulent a financial transaction or otherwise. And I think to correct that, you need to include how they would include those attorney fees, and I would put under Minnesota Statute 8.31, which is the private attorney general statute, which is no longer available to consumers when it's only a one-in-one fraud. It has to be a fraud against two people or more before I can access 8.31. I've long worried about that, and this is maybe an opportunity to give some tools back to both the agency and consumers to protect themselves. The other just note that I would make on this process, and it's not specifically listed, but this there isn't really a process for the commissioner to go ahead and impose this, and I think you should make certain that those are subject to the Administrative Procedures Act so that someone who is accused when it's not a conviction has some due process and procedural rights. Mr. Chairman, to the remainder of the bill itself, sections 1 and 4, you know, despite the comments, you need to know that section 1 of the bill precludes anyone from getting access to those records for the first 30 days. Not the media, not a neighborhood watch group, not a sexual assault group that is worried about any crime report. That section 1 of the bill amends chapter 13 as it did last year, and that precludes anyone from getting a government-generated public data accident reports for the first 30 days. Now, we do not support denying anyone access to public data, and this simply just goes too far. Then when you look at section 4, which is not in the Data Practices Act, but is in chapter 169, where accident records are dealt with for the Department of Public Safety, you do expand the people who can get it, but you don't remove the prohibition as it relates to the 30-day period. And I'm not encouraging you to go there, but what I'm saying is that you have not linked up the data practices of accident records, and you are denying people the chance to get legitimate information, legitimate public information to use for legitimate purposes. And I get just as many letters. I haven't been in an accident for a while, thankfully. But I know people don't like getting those records, some of those letters in the mail. But many times, that is the information you get that inform you of your rights. You know that you have an insurance policy. You know that you have the right to legal representation. And many times, I agree, people believe they're a nuisance, and they throw them away. I get more information from insurance companies, quite frankly, than I do from lawyers or chiropractors or anyone else. It's advertising, and it is giving people information about things that they need to know if they've been involved in an accident. And so we have very serious concerns about the legitimate use of that information and, at its base, denying everyone access to public data. So we, too, are happy to continue to work with you. We have concerns about that provision and its impact, not just on auto accident victims, but it applies to any law agency record that's created. So we're not quite as laser-focused as what we would hope, and we do have serious concerns about that. As always, Mr. Chairman, happy to answer questions that you might have, and we will, of course, watch this bill through the process and appreciate working with Senator Jensen and yourself on all kinds of issues as the session moves forward.
Senator Jensen, I'm assuming it's your intent that those listed in Section 4 are able to access the data within the first 30 days.
That's correct.
So we just have to decide or make sure that that's clear. Do you have any comments on that, Mr. Stang?
A couple, Mr. Chairman, but I get out of my depth quickly on this data privacy stuff, and that's really an issue for the Judiciary Committee. The information in Section 1 is not exactly the same as what the information talked about in Section 4. And Section 1 pulls out elements of information related to a police response to an incident, which is public, and Section 4 relates to the actual traffic report that's written up by law enforcement. They're not exactly the same things in each section. So I'm not sure it's completely messed up here, but I think a committee further down the line doing good work could confirm that and make sure we're not doing something wrong.
And Mr. Chair, members, last year when the bill came through, I remember it being heard in Senator Dibble's committee and Senator Kent was there, Section 1, I think, was universally opposed by Data Practices Act experts, the Newspaper Association, and everyone else, because that really does shut down public access to all accident and police-generated data, which I don't think is the intent and is a step in the direction we wouldn't want to go. Then we get to the accident records itself, and that's a different subject we can deal with. This one just is a quite a blunt tool.
Yeah. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intention of Section 1 was to provide a 30-day cooling-off period for everybody. But we recognized that because of the hearings that we had last year, that somehow we do need to have the people like media have access to that, and primarily people that are involved with the crash so that people can make a claim and do those types of things. And all the people that Carlson was talking about. So we recognize that, and that's the intention. And if there are changes that we need to make happen to do that, I'm very open and have been through the entire process for the 2 years to make sure that what the intention is, what's happening. I am pretty confident, though, that we will probably never come to a complete agreement on the accessibility of those records to everybody. So just in recognition of that, I'm willing to work on that particular item and make sure that we follow the data practices that we need to have happen within this legislation. But I think that it's important that we understand the intention that we don't make these accident records available to people that are not involved with the accident and need to be involved in that process.
Thank you. Senator Reiner, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know that we ever come to complete agreement on anything here, right? We're not supposed to. It's democracy. I just, a couple things. First of all, Senator Jensen, thank you for all your work on this. I think we need to remind everyone that you put in a few years on this now along with some others. And when you and I met the other day, I held up the report from the first group because I've saved it. It's a solid report, well written, well put together. Our intention, of course, is to lay these over and continue to work on this. And I know you've been interested in engaging all those partners. I think we should just keep that in mind. Mr. Chair, want to make sure that we have some time to talk about the other bill as well, because I think they really are tandem. I mean, one is sort of trying to maybe get us caught up on some issues, but the other is how are we going to talk to each other and work together moving forward. And I think we maybe do ourselves a disservice if we think of them as two separate things.
If we can vote and move this to the full Commerce Committee, because we're still all going to be looking at it again, then we can get to the other one. Is that okay, members?
And Mr. Chairman, just on the records, because it goes to really the problem that we have with a delay in release of the records. What they don't tell you is that there's no prohibition for the insurance company to settle your claim in those first 30 days when you don't even know what your rights may or may not be. And those little blue and white trucks from Progressive that run around and go to the accident site, they're offering to settle with you on the spot right now. And our concern is that that happens in a way that the consumer just doesn't get the information that they need, and they go to their lawyer after the fact when they do have serious problems and say, well, I signed this document that said I waived any right to a future claim, and we see that happen too. So there's two sides to that coin, and it isn't that we want to flood everybody's mailbox with unneeded mail. It's that you really do have important rights that need to be protected. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah,
thank you. So we have to move Senator Jensen moves Senate file. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question that I'm a little bit concerned about. And this is for Senator Jensen. We've heard a couple of examples of fraudulent activities that I'm wondering, are these going to be covered somewhere? For instance, we heard about the glass replacement person that's coming up there, and I'm assuming we were talking about a fraudulent level glass replacement. Also, we were talking about the replacement of faulty airbags that were not certified. Those are different providers than medical providers. And should we be including those in the providers that we're describing, plus the providers that we deauthorize? Maybe even we should include the attorneys that chased after these people.
Mr. Chair, Senator Claussen, I want people to keep in mind that this bill is any insurance fraud and a person. And we changed subdivision 2A to person convicted of insurance fraud. So I don't know how that changes your question. I would ask if counsel has an opinion on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, I think he's correct. Section 3 wouldn't apply to those because it's tied into medical benefits under no fault. Section 2 as drafted would affect those if they are found guilty of insurance fraud. And I think as described, those potentially could be. So I think Section 2 could apply to it, but Section 3 is drafted as just medical benefit, no fraud.
Members, let's wrap this up because I want to give a little time on 957. As I mentioned, it's going, if it passes, it's going to the full Commerce Committee. So Senator Jensen moves Senate File 782 as amended to be recommended pass and re-referred to the
full Commerce
Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Fails. Senator Jensen, you have Senate File 957.
Yes, 957, and I do have Amendment A1 that I would like to put on Senate File 957.
All right, we'll wait for that to briefly to get out. This is an author's amendment.
I think we have it.
Yeah, everybody got that?
Public
Durbin.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we
have it. Senator Jensen moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Yep.
Amendment carries. Senator Jensen, to your bill as amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the previous bill, I think we heard a lot about no fault. It came up several times from several different testifiers. And that's what we found in the working group, too, that there are several issues that surround our no-fault auto that was put into place in the 1970s. There have been some attempts to make some changes. But what the working group did is they put down specific issues on an issue matrix, and you should have a copy of that. So I want you to understand where this bill is coming from. Some of these issues are going to need an in-depth, long look through a task force, and that's what this bill would do. It would bring together people that need to come to the table. You heard Representative Abler talk about we need the people that are affected by this at the table, and that's what this bill is an attempt to do, is to bring stakeholders together run by the Commerce Department where they would have an actual task force take a look at the issues under the no-fault auto that we haven't taken up yet legislatively. So they would include the arbitration process, the treatment standards, fee schedules, and provider oversight includes several issues that came up during the working group that we would also take a look at. I also want to say that if there is somebody that is looking at this, the amendment goes to people that have come forward that need to be on the working group are on the task force, and we've added them to the list. I think we have a pretty good representation, and maybe we'll hear from some people that need to be added, and I'm very open to taking a look at that if people want to speak to that.
Senator Jensen, I'm thinking that maybe we just have testify the people that either want to be added to it or are opposed. I think we have a sense of who is in favor of it, and you know, if that's all right with you, I'd...
That's perfectly fine with me.
All right, so is there anybody that wants, that's not on the list or is opposed to this, that would like to come and testify?
Amendment?
We do.
You good?
Sir, or, sorry, Mr. Goodnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Kevin Goodnow on behalf of the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. I'm actually not opposed to it, but I would suggest that maybe under duties that we have a catch-all that covers all other items and no fault that come up during the committee, because it seems to be fairly focused, and I think there's some issues that providers have that may we might want to discuss as well.
So, Mr. Goodnow, would you be comfortable with that being worked on between here and full Congress?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. And I appreciate this being brought forward. I think it would be a very good piece of legislation.
Thank you. Anyone else? Mr. Abler.
Well, now it's my second time. I can just kind of relax and enjoy it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate what you've done in the first bill and the dialogue, and the author is going to consider all those concerns. And I appreciate the process. And I appreciate that the group understands the need for inclusion. And just understand also, as this goes forward and there may be other people that want to be added, and my advice would be either add them or make sure that people know the microphone is open to those. And also recognize that all the groups listed represent a minority of their professional group. And so I had occasion to talk to a medical group, psychiatrists and psychologists in particular, and they were worried about some data thing, and they said that the group that's around representing doctors represents like 20% of that particular subset. So I'm just aware of that. So as you, the public may be interested, even with random individuals coming forward, and I know you'll be interested in that. You might also want to throw some kind of consumer type person on there, Madam Chair. But some other topics you might include as well as just the catch-all other. The assignment of benefits issue, which is a perpetual situation. We talked about providers' ability to know about claim status.
Too much to do with the 20.
Whistleblowers, what happens to them? There was some work done before about that. And then other things that just come up. And I think with the bill, the bill that's even just been passed is going to evolve a bit as it moves along to reflect the concerns. And none of us expect that we get to control that. We have influence. We give you our best advice. And then in the wisdom of the people that are taking all the data in, they make a judgment based upon where they choose to go. And I think when people know that, then people would otherwise not come forward with their input will come forward and offer you advice that you hadn't even considered. And that was our secret, Mr. Chair, a couple years ago. And I know that the track that we're off with Chair and her interest, it's going to be like that again. And I think at the end you'll have a product you might not even expect it that will cover more content and more dollars and more of the bad things while preserving all the good things while you work to restore the losses and make your injured clients whole. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Any questions, members? Senator Pratt.
Not really a question, Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. I remember at one of our first meetings at the Fraud Task Force, we had Senator Jack Davies address us, and he was the original author of the No-Fault Insurance, and I'll never forget his comment was, when I did this 40 years ago, I didn't expect that there'd be no changes over that period of time, and so I'm encouraged and happy to see us moving forward with a well-rounded group to help bring this, to modernize this specific law and provision. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. And one comment on my part, too. We, I believe it was as many as 25 states had no fault, and now we're down to about 9. And I think part of it is because people were not willing to take a hard look at it again, and we are. So, Senator Jensen, thank you for bringing this forward. And with that, Senator Jensen moves Senate File 957 as amended and recommended to be passed and referred to the full Commerce Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. With that, members, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.